This is Samuel's Persiflage, episode number 6 for July 2006. Yes, hello and welcome to another episode of Samuel's Persiflage. It's been a little while since the last one, but we're here now and we're just going to have to see about making this a little bit more regular, I think. Having 2 months between episodes simply isn't acceptable, and we're behind on the episode numbers, so, well, I've got a bit of scope there to improve on that, so I'll see what I can do. And let's start doing that by having today's episode. Well, we've got plenty coming up today. Pia Waugh, one of the organisers of linux.conf.au 2007, will be joining us in a few moments. We've got plenty of feedback to go through. Some interesting information about some phone scams that are doing the rounds at the moment. We'll go through that. There's also a persiflage puzzle and plenty more, so stay tuned. You're listening to Samuel's Persiflage. And as I said, we've got a persiflage puzzle, and for those of you who are new to the show, I'll explain how it works. Basically, I give you a puzzle that's similar to Hangman or Wheel of Fortune or whatever, and I give you some letters, I tell you where they are in the puzzle, or if they're not in the puzzle, you fill them in and you try and work out what it is. It's a bit of fun to keep us going through the show, so I'm sure you'll enjoy it, I know I do. Now, this time round we have 2 words, so if you are new, you'll probably need to know that you do need a piece of paper and a pen or a text editor or something. Fire that up and we'll put in the 2 words. The first word has 7 letters, and the second word has 4 letters. And the clue for this puzzle, you would be hard-pressed to find a shopping centre which doesn't have at least one of these. I'll start by giving you 3 letters, which I'll draw out of this hat here. Okay, let's shuffle around in there. The first letter out is the letter M for Mary. And as luck would have it, that is the 3rd letter of the first word. We'll get out another letter, and it's the letter S for Samuel. And that's the 3rd letter in the 2nd word. So that's looking good, and we'll pull out 1 more letter this time round. Having a look, here it is. It's the letter D for dog, and that happens to be the 1st letter of the 2nd word. So have a think about that. We'll see how you go. We'll have another update on the persiflage puzzle a little bit later on. In the previous episode of Samuel's Persiflage, we spoke with Margaret Phillips, the Director of Digital Archiving at the National Library of Australia. Margaret had been with the National Library for quite some time at that stage, and she has since retired. Now, as is the general policy for guests on Samuel's Persiflage, I send out an audio CD of the episode that the guests appear on. And seeing as the National Library isn't too far from where I live, I hand-delivered it to her. Now, on Margaret's last day as Director of Digital Archiving, which was in fact Friday, June the 16th, she sent me an email. She wrote, "Dear Samuel, I'm sorry that I have not been in touch with you before this to thank you for the CD that you delivered to me containing your interview with me. I have only today been able to listen to it, and then with only half an ear open. It's my last day in the library and I've been finishing off many things. However, I shall take it home with me and listen to it with more attention next week. I must have been a bit tired the day you interviewed me because I'm speaking slowly and with some hesitation. I did a little better when talking about Pandora because I'm much more familiar with it. Many thanks for the interview and your good wishes for my retirement. All the very best to you for the future, Margaret." Well, as it happens, I did contact Margaret to wish her the very best for her retirement. And I'd just like to do that publicly because Margaret is one of the main people responsible for Pandora, the National Library's attempt at archiving the Australian websites that are out there on the internet. And in many ways, without Margaret there, it probably wouldn't have happened, or at least it wouldn't be where it is now. So Margaret has had a very important part in the history of Australian, well, the National Library, really. Margaret's done a number of things there. Pandora's just one of them. And so I'd like to publicly wish Margaret the very best for her retirement. Thank her once again for coming on the show. And maybe sometime in the future we'll hear from her again. Maybe she's listening to this. But it was wonderful being able to chat with Margaret. Really do appreciate her time. And in many ways, her interview was one of her parting gifts as the Director of Digital Archiving at the National Library. So, Margaret, you will be missed, and thank you very much for coming on the show, and I hope you have a great retirement. Linux.conf.au is on again next year. This time it's in Sydney and it's in January. Pia Waugh is one of the organisers of Linux.conf.au, Australia's premier Linux conference, I suppose you could call it. Pia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So, could you tell us a little bit about Linux.conf.au? What is it about?
Sure, Linux.conf.au is one of the world's best technical Linux conferences. Basically, it attracts the likes of Linus Torvalds, of Alan Cox, Rusty Russell, Andrew Tridgell, all the big names in the space. And the reason that they all come and keep coming back is because, well, frankly, it's extremely fun. It's very technical. It's very community-based. It's definitely not a corporate sort of marketing-style conference. It really is by the community and for the community. And because every year it's actually run by a different group of volunteers, usually some Linux user group from around the country, it sort of has that feel, that community feel that's really comfortable and fun and interesting. So, yeah, definitely one of the best conferences in the world. I've been to conferences, free and open source software conferences all around the world, and it has to be one of my favourites, definitely.
Okay. It started in Melbourne in 1999, didn't it?
Yes, that was back then it was called CALU, the Conference of Australian Linux Users, and the year after that it ran, then it missed a year, and then it ran in Sydney, and they changed the name to linux.conf.au after finding out that they could use the conf.au domain.
Right. So that's the entire reason behind the name, or?
Well, I mean, it just sort of sounded cool, and they thought it was an interesting domain name to use, and they thought that it would be memorable. And as it is something that people remember. Unfortunately, the linux.conf.au domain is a difficult thing to keep because the conf.au domains actually retire once a year, so we have to sort of we end up going through a period of a couple of months every year where we can't use the domain, which is very frustrating.
Mm.
So what we're trying to do is to stick to lca2007.linux.org.au so that people can always use that domain then.
Yep. I must say, saying LCA is much, much quicker and easier, so we might just go with that for now.
No problem.
Okay, so The call for papers is already open for next year. What sort of topics are you looking for?
We've actually got... what we did was we went and had a look back through the conference at the streams of and tried to sort of put things into to streams. And so we've actually come up with 6 or 7 core streams that that we're trying to get people to think about. And they include sysadmin, security, cool hacks, tools and stuff for programmers, and free culture. So there's a couple of other ones, but unfortunately I don't have the information in front of me because I'm on offline at the moment, which is most painful.
You're in Armidale at the moment, aren't you?
I am. I'm giving a talk tomorrow today at a university here, and there is no wireless left anywhere, so I'm a little bit starved at the moment.
That's something that wireless is something you should find at LCA though, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. You'll be fully connected, and what we're also doing is making sure that the website delivers all the information people need, both before the conference and during the conference. So you know, every morning, including the days of the mini conf, we're going to have announcements. We're going to be saying everything that's happening that day. We're going to have the opportunity for people to find out about the cool stuff easily, rather than having to just rely on even just the website or the booklet they'll be getting in their pack. So plenty of opportunity for people to participate in various ways.
Right, right. So with the call for papers, going back to that again, you'll obviously end up with a lot of very technical speeches, but is that the only sort of speeches you want, or do you want some of the more general topics as well?
Well, the great thing about LinuxConf.au is the demographic of that conference is changing a little every year. We still have a huge proportion of developers, whether that be coders or documenters or user interface people or any of those sort of groups, or even translators and such. But we're also getting a lot more people that are interested in the community and free culture. The mini-conf that we run every year are actually community streams, so they're actually run by people in the community that want to run a mini-conf of a particular type. And watching the mini-conf change over the years is a really good indication of how, the different things people are interested in. So last year, for instance, or this year, 2006, we had a education mini-conf. We had, for 2007, some people have put in applications to run like a research mini-conf and a legal mini-conf and all this kind of stuff, as well as your traditional, security mini-conf or Debian mini-conf, KDE mini-conf and all those kinds of things. So the mini-conf really provide a opportunity for the community to create any sort of mini-conf that they want that suits whatever they care about. And then the main conference, we sort of bandy around those streams that we've put together, which are of most general interest.
Right.
But even those streams do include free culture and cool hacks. So there are sort of a lot of generic talks, and the keynotes we try to make sure are broadly applicable to everybody.
Right. So just to clarify for the people who haven't been to LCA before, the mini-conf's sort of mini-conferences, really, that you just run in the few days before the actual conference gets underway?
What we're doing, so usually the layout has been 2 days of mini-conf, 1 day of tutorials and 2 days of lectures, with a sort of, a last day of best of talks and such. What we're doing for 2007 is we're saying, okay, the entire conference starts on the first day of the first mini-conf. So we're trying to open it as the mini-conf's open to try and encourage more people to participate in the mini-conf. So the Monday and the Tuesday will be mini-conf days, but the Monday will be when the conference actually starts. Wednesday will be talks, Thursday will be tutorials, and Friday will be talks. And the reason we put the tutorials and moved it back to Thursday was so that people had a chance to be in talks, stream-associated talks before they went into the tutorials the next day, so they had a chance to meet people and get the most out of the tutorials when they go into them.
Right. Okay. Well, there'd be a lot of my audience who are still very much Windows users, probably still using Internet Explorer, Microsoft Office, all of the proprietary software.
Yep.
One of the main topics, I suppose, the real topic at LCA is open source software. And a lot of people have heard a lot about it, but might not necessarily understand much about it. So would you like to enlighten us a little bit, I suppose, is probably the wrong word, but never mind.
Oh, it depends, I guess. absolutely. So open source software ultimately is a couple of things. First of all, it's a development methodology which is community-based. So most of your listeners would have heard about the concept of the commons. So in old England, you have, you know, a patch of land that the community, no one owned, but the entire community put a little bit of work in, and then the entire community got the, you know, the benefits of the of a good harvest, effectively. Open source software is basically community developed software. It's basically a commons for software. No one owns the software outright. There's no single owner or single company behind it. But rather, there's a lot of individuals, a lot of companies, and a lot of communities who participate in creating something which suits a variety of needs. And again, it's quite interesting because rather than one company sitting down and doing an analysis of what they think their users want, you end up getting the actual users and developers getting in and creating what they actually need. And you might have one application, for instance, that you might have, you know, 1,000 people developing on from all different walks of life. So you end up with an application which is very broadly applicable rather than applicable just in one or two different key ways. So what's happening is that open source software has been around for some time now, something like Linux, which is one of the most famous open source projects. It's an operating system, and most people refer to it as GNU Linux. And it is a stack of, it's basically an operating system with a stack of applications on top. But it's not even really right to just compare it to Windows, because Windows is really just an operating system with a few key tools. Then you have to buy your, you know, Microsoft Office, which is another application. And then most other applications are third-party. You know, Adobe Acrobat, you might use Photoshop, you might use all these other applications that are actually third-party. Whereas in Linux, you've literally got, you know, thousands and thousands of applications that are free and easily available to you. And a lot of those applications have actually been ported to Windows. So you can actually run OpenOffice, which is a open-source office suite, which has been ported to Linux, Windows, and Mac. You can use something like Firefox, which is an open-source Internet Explorer equivalent, you know, a browser, although it's, some would argue better than Internet Explorer because it has less viruses and more features, but that's been ported to Windows and to Mac. So even people that are running Windows and comfortable with Windows are able to take advantage of open-source software and start, you know, using the stuff even if they don't need to participate in it at this point. The greatest thing about open-source, though, regardless of this next-generation development methodology, is the community around it. So you have this huge global community which is online 24/7 because it's all around the world. You have over 1 million people registered on one particular place called SourceForge, where there is a lot of open-source software registered. So it's a huge community of people, and you can always find a group or a application or a community that suits sort of what you care about. And so you have a backup, you have access to information, you have access to help and support, that you really don't get that sense of community with proprietary software, because people at the core of it are sort of bound by these core values of, you know, personal freedom, of personal empowerment, and of being able to get on and get the job done in the open source community. So it's a very powerful thing.
I suppose that one of the main things about having the community there is that with all the software being in the open domain, you can really create something that suits your needs or suits the needs of a particular group. I mean, there's I don't know how many Linux distributions there are. There's too many to count, but there's a lot of what I'd sort of call your desktop variations, and then you've got a lot of desktop variations for a certain specific group of people, and you've got other versions for various types of servers and various other needs.
And you also get things like so GNOME is a Windows a suite of desktop applications, if you like, so the stuff that you feel and touch and use when you log into a GUI user interface. And GNOME, for instance, has been translated into so many languages, and there's even they came up with one release, and there was a Mongolian, you know, full translation within a few days, because there are some people who in Mongolia who wanted to have it translated, and because the code is available for them to be able to do that, they could just get in and do it. So you end up with all of these translations that are free. The other thing I was going to say, your readers, if they do want to have a bit of a look, a bit of a feel and touch, I mean, they can download some of this software and play with it. The distributions of Linux that I would recommend for desktop users would be Ubuntu, SUSE, and Red Hat. There's also another distribution called Mandriva, and between the four of those, you tend to find something that suits you. The other thing is that at linux.conf.au, at LCA, we're actually running a brand new thing called Open Day. You can get details about Open Day on the website now. Open Day is a free event that we're running where we'll have lots and lots of cool technologies, robots, solar cars, all kinds of technology that runs on open source. We'll have all the people there behind this technology, so you can sort of look and ask and feel and have the people there to answer your questions. And you can get a feel about the community, because we'll be really showing off some of the coolest projects and coolest people in the community. So it's a free event. There's a sausage sizzle there, and you know it'll be a fun sort of family holiday event that people can come along to and see what this is all about.
Just having a look on the LCA website at the moment, there's a pamphlet on there for the Open Day too.
Yes.
So if anyone needs information about that, LCA... Oh dear, phone's going off in the studio. I'm sorry, someone should be downstairs. They've got it. Okay. What was I saying? This is something that happens all the time on this show. We either have dogs barking in the background, we have phones going off, it just all happens in here. But yeah, lca2007.linux.org.au, there'll be a link to it in the show notes. There's information about LCA 2007, there's the Open Day, the event pamphlet there. I suppose I should also include some links to some of the Linux distributions and office suites as well.
Sure, and I mean, if you need to find a lot of information, I can certainly email you through and send you all those links.
I think the other thing that I was going to say about having the open source community there is that with most of them, there's so many people there that if you do get stuck, you just have to go to a forum or to a mailing list, and within a few moments, you probably have an answer to your problem.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the fantastic thing. There is a user group in most places in Australia. There's about 35 user groups around Australia, which is actually quite a lot for one country. There are many countries where they only have one or two. We've got a thing called Software Freedom Day coming up on the 16th of September, and there'll be information about that on the linux.org.au website very soon. And that's another opportunity to just get some information from a user group near you about open source. There's plenty of opportunities to find information, to get help, to get assistance. And you'll also find that the documentation freely available on the web is very, very easy. So, for instance, my personal distribution of choice is Ubuntu. I find it very easy to use. And there's actually an Ubuntu user guide online, which is very comprehensive, easy to read, very easy to implement. So there's a lot of help out there, and it's just such a fantastic world to get involved in.
Right. Okay, well, going back to LCA, what are some of your personal favourite highlights of previous years?
Oh, there's so many. A couple of years ago, Linus Torvalds came to LCA, and Linus Torvalds, for those who don't know, is sort of one of the people who started. He started writing the Linux kernel, if you like, and started the whole thing off. Anyway, he came to a conference, and when he was asked to come back the next year, he said only if we could get a dunking tank. And we thought, oh, this sounds so much fun. And the team of the time, which was Adelaide, said, sure. And they organised a dunking tank. And then what they did was have an auction where people bidded for the right dunk their favourite developer. All of that money went to charity. Every year we have a charity run, and it goes to a charity of the choice of the team running it that year. Linus got dunked, my husband got dunked, Keith Packard, Badal Garbi, loads of sort of big names in that space. All had to, you know, don their swimmers and get onto a on top of a big tub of water and be dunked. So that was a lot of fun. Every year, again, we try to do fun stuff because it really is that kind of thing. Every year there's great talks. I think one of my favourite talks was actually back in Melbourne in Cowie in 99, where a guy called John Madsock Hall spoke, and he spoke about not just about technical stuff, but about freedom and about all the things that makes open source important beyond just the technical scope of what it can do. And that was really inspiring. That really sort of got me involved to the point that I'm involved now. So Yeah, I mean, there's lots of highlights. It's such a fun conference. I go every year.
Hmm. I suppose the other thing that I probably should ask is, if people just want to know more about Linux, they might not have used it before necessarily, would you think if they have time off in January and they're planning on being in Sydney, do you think perhaps they would gain something from attending LCA?
I think that it is a very technical conference. The best thing that they could do would be to come along to the open day. Come along, say hello, see what they think. I think that will give them a taste of the community, a taste of what's possible. We'll make sure that there's plenty of software and information available at that day so that people can just pick it up and take it home. But the conference, unless there's a particular mini-conf that they're interested in, so for instance teachers interested in this space or who want to know about this space should go to the education mini-conf. That'll give them 2 days or 1 day of finding out how it's relevant to their space without sort of delving into the more technical stuff that we will in the main conference. But, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Keep an eye on the website as we start posting what the mini-comps are and what the schedule is. And certainly come along to Open Day. We'd love to see you there.
That website again, lca2007.linux.org.au. There'll be a link in the show notes. Pia, thank you very much for coming on the show.
No, that's not a problem. It was lovely. Thank you very much.
Pia Waugh is one of the organisers of linux.conf.au 2007, being held in January in Sydney. Samuel's Persiflage listener feedback coming up in just a moment. But how are you going with the Persiflage puzzle? Would you like some more letters, perhaps? I think I can help you with that. We will draw out 4 letters from the hat this time. And the first letter out is the letter X for X-ray. And, well, that's not in there. So, let's draw out another letter. What have we got? It's the letter R for Roger. That one's not in there either. Alrighty then, let's try another one. And there we go. It's the letter F for Fred. No, that's not in there either. And we'll try for one more. See if we can get this one to be in there. So we get it's the letter B for Bob. That one's not in there either. 4 letters that aren't in there, but the letters that aren't in there, they're very important too, because if you know some of the letters that aren't in there, it helps you work out which letters are in there. And the clue again, in case you missed it earlier, which you shouldn't have because this is a podcast, so most people listen to all of it, or at least start from the beginning. The clue for this puzzle, you would be hard-pressed to find a shopping centre which doesn't have at least one of these.
Samuel's Persiflage listener feedback. Send your emails to podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com.
Oh, I love this time of the show. It's where you get to take part in the show and send in your feedback. podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address, as you've just heard. Or you can send audio feedback, go to the link on the Samuel's Persiflage website. From memory, it's odeo.com/sendamessage/SamuelGS or something like that. Can't remember the exact address, but that doesn't really matter because there's a button on there that says send me a voice message. If you click on that, it'll take you to the good people at odeo.com. which will guide you through recording the whole thing. It'll even send it straight to me, and that makes it easier for everyone. Of course, you can also send spoken feedback via WAV format, MP3 format, or Ogvorbis format to that email address, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com. Or you can do it the good old-fashioned way and send it in text form, again, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com. All of those forms are highly appreciated, and I'd love to get your feedback and get it on the show. So let's start off the feedback for this episode, and we've got one from John B1B5. He sent in some audio.
Hello, Samuel. John B1B5 here. Congratulations on your best persiflage so far. And congratulations also to Margaret Phillips for clearly explaining what Pandora was all about.
Thank you very much for that there, John. I actually had an opportunity to convey your message to Margaret Phillips, and she wrote back, thank you very much for this positive feedback. So thank you very much for that, John. I appreciate it, and so does Margaret. So it's very thoughtful of you. Chuck writes, do comments appear in Pandora 2? Now, Chuck is referring to the comments on my blog, or on any website for that matter. The answer to that is yes, they do, because when the Pandora robot comes in, it goes and indexes the entire website, and it plops it all into Pandora right there. It's pretty much a carbon copy version of what you would see on the website. The only difference with some websites is you can't log into them on the Pandora copy because they don't have all of that back-end stuff. It's just what gets rendered on your screen, that's what they're going to get at Pandora. So you can't log in, you can't leave new comments, etc. on the Pandora copy. But, of course, you can still leave them on my website, so that's fine. Clayton has sent us in a very long email, so we'll read this out. Samuel. In your latest persiflage, you didn't show much appreciation for the new display device that you brought up through the single example of public transport. On second thoughts, maybe we should play that segment from the last episode. We'll play that and then we'll come back and read the email. According to EE Times, an Israeli company has developed a personal video display device that looks like a simple pair of glasses. You can use these glasses with various sources, such as a portable media player or your cell phone. Well, why? I'm just thinking about this. If you're on public transport, for example, and you're wearing headphones to listen to music or even a podcast, such as Samuel's Persiflage, that's not too bad, because if you've got the volume down low enough, you can hear your surroundings and you can still see your surroundings quite easily. Now, if you have video glasses on and you're watching something, well, you're going to need the sound as well, so you're going to have the earphones. So not only are you eliminating most background noise, so eliminating the noise from your surroundings, you're also eliminating the visuals of your surroundings. So not only can you not hear what's going on around you, you can't see what's going on around you. So to start with, I don't know how you're going to see your stop if you're on the bus or the train. And I certainly don't know how this is going to work in terms of personal safety, because you will occasionally get unscrupulous people on public transport or just in general day-to-day out in public. And I don't think I'd really want to be blocking out my surroundings with those people around. I mean, some people would, but not me. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that one. Okay, so now that we've refreshed your memory about that, let's go back to Clayton's email. If you had widened your view to include further examples that are not and cannot be tailored to your subjective view of this issue, you would not have inadvertently slandered the name of the poor Israelis and the new technology they have created. As a well-travelled person in flight and road, travelling excess of 20 hours on an international flight to London, a little less to Paris and Rome, not including compulsory stopovers, usually of a night to Singapore, Jakarta, Dubai or Hong Kong, also, taking into account those not as well off as some, like myself, who can afford first or business class seats and must buy economy class, the mere opportunity of watching and listening to a movie that you choose from your own personal collection of DVDs, rather than having your selection dictated to you by the flight company, is certainly worth the cost difference between an economy class and a business class. Similarly, as a regular passenger in long road trips across Australia and internationally, you may note, next time you're in a car, that there is no video audio setup for cars made prior to the past 2 years, and that if you indeed wanted one, you would have to fork out a significant amount of money to afford such a system in older cars. This can also be dangerous in that it provides a substantial amount of distraction for the driver, whose primary objective is to concentrate on the road ahead. This new invention would eliminate all distraction for the driver while enhancing the experience for the passenger. Note, young Samuel, that not everyone is enamored with radio. Perhaps in your further podcasts you could refrain from passing judgment on a well-thought piece of technology before you consider all its uses rather than one that you choose to give. Objectivity is the key to being a successful reporter. Well, Clayton, I must admit, I didn't think of the long trip example. Probably because the article that I was basing my story and my opinion on, it seemed to really just talk about it more in public transport terms, and I personally catch public transport a lot, so it didn't really occur to me at the time. It should have, but it didn't. So, yeah. Look, you're right. You're right. The long trips, long road trips, whatever, it's a great idea for that. But you'd have to agree that in a public environment such as a bus or a train or something like that, I'm talking suburban buses and suburban trains here, maybe it's not such a great idea on them because there's people coming and going all the time. You never really know who's going to be on there or what's going to happen. And having something expensive on that that's blocking out all of your main perceptions isn't really going to be great for your own security. But certainly for the long trips on planes or trains or buses, whatever, even car trips, certainly a great idea. Very, very good idea. So thank you very much for that, Clayton. Much appreciated. Sandra writes, what was wrong with Margaret's phone? I could understand her, but the sound quality was terrible. Well, you know, I'm not really sure that there was anything wrong with Margaret's phone, because I could hear it just fine when I was recording the interview. The problem there was that we were using our old phone system. The old phone system consisted of a standard computer modem with voice capability, and the sound quality wasn't great. There's also the problem there that because I was using that, I also had to use a real phone to talk to Margaret or whoever else I happened to be interviewing. This meant that my voice came through a lot louder on the recording of the phone, and therefore they were much quieter. It also meant I had to run a separate recording for the studio microphone. I had to try and line the things up. I had to try and remove sections of the phone line audio where my voice was because it just sounded absolutely ridiculous having that echo and trying to line it up when computers, due to their clocks, tend to run at slightly different timing speeds. So it was just a mess, basically. It's amazing that it worked at all, to be perfectly honest with you. We've put up with it for long enough, and, you know, you're not the only person to send me emails about it. I didn't particularly like it either, and you might have noticed that Pierre War, who we spoke to not long ago, was actually much clearer. That's because we're using the new phone system. Yes, we've got a new phone system at last, and it's great to have it. The new phone system makes use of Skype. So basically it's just Skype, a computer, and another computer recording. It's great. It's brilliant. It means we don't have to worry about it. It also means there's less editing because it's just one audio file. I can easily mix it on the fly so I don't have to try and do too much post-processing. It also means that the phone signal is clearer for multiple reasons. Basically, with Skype, because of the way they have all their phone systems set up, I'm using the closest phone line I can with Skype to the person that I'm talking to. So if I was using the old phone system and I wanted to talk to someone in London and I'm in Canberra, it'd be standard phone system right all the way through. That's copper wires all over the place. The new phone system, it's digitally preserved from pretty much, if they're on the phone, it's digitally preserved from here to the Skype call center in London. phone centre might be better, data centre perhaps, I don't know, in London, and then it goes copper wire from there. But basically you have a much clearer signal, and, well, it's cheaper too, and it works really well. Pia, incidentally, was on a mobile phone in a very noisy place, so it was actually amazing that it came through, and I really don't think you would have been able to understand a word of it on the old phone system, so I'm really happy that we have that new phone system in there. Let's see, who's next? We've got John B1B5 again. John actually sent in a second email. He said, interesting to hear that Screen Sound Australia has gone back to calling itself the National Film and Sound Archive. I can remember when the National Library used to keep film in the library itself, and in 1988 I went there and watched the full version of Triumph of the Will, a 1934 movie, on a small console viewer in the viewing room. It cost me nothing. That film is no longer held at the library, and I would have to go to the National Film and Sound Archive to watch it. Problem is, it would now cost me $21.50 per hour viewing, plus a $21.50 retrieval fee to get it out of storage at Mitchell, a total of $43. Oh well, I guess it's a user-pays environment these days. John, you're right. It is. It's a user-pay environment these days. Mind you, you have to wonder how much money the National Film and Sound Archive have spent on the administrative matters of changing their name to Screen Sound Australia and then back again, so that's an interesting one there. I'd actually be very interested to find out how much that did cost. But yeah, I suppose, I know, these are sort of essential parts of our history in many ways, aren't they? I mean, I know they have to preserve them. Perhaps it's because it is such an old film that it costs more. But you'd think that for at least standard films in good condition that aren't likely to corrode or whatever, you'd think that perhaps you could have a threshold of free viewings of things per year for people. I mean, it is our history after all. Surely it should be freely available to all of us. What do you think? Send me an email or a voice message. podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com or click on the Send Me a Voice Message button on the Samuel's Persiflage website. Anyway, that's the feedback for this month. We'll have more next month. Alrighty then, time for a thought for the month. Why is it that a surplus is a surplus, but a deficit is not a surminus?
You're listening to Samuel's Persiflage.
Time for another update of the Persiflage puzzle, I think. The clue again, you would be hard-pressed to find a shopping centre which doesn't have at least one of these. So let's continue pulling letters out of the hat. We'll pull five out this time, and then we'll see if you can work it out before the end of the episode. First out of the hat this time round is the letter P for Peter. It's in the puzzle. I'm glad we finally have a letter in the puzzle. It's the fourth letter of the first word. Let's go in and get out another letter. It's the letter U for unicorn. That one's not in there, I'm afraid. Let's go in and see what we get out this time. It's that would be the letter Z for zebra. And that one's not in there either, I'm afraid. Let's see if we can pull out another one. Let's go in there. What have we got? It's N for Nathan. N for Natty, I suppose. Natty, of course, being my lovely little doggy. But no, I'm afraid not. There are no N's in this puzzle. Oh dear. Let's see if we can find a letter this time. Here we go. It's the letter C for cat, and there are three of them in the puzzle. The first letter of the first word is a C, as is the sixth letter of the first word, and the fourth letter of the second word. You would be hard-pressed to find a shopping centre which doesn't have at least one of these. I'll tell you what the answer is at the end of the episode. There seems to be a few interesting telephone scams going around at the moment. Michael sent me an email. Hi Samuel, I listen to your podcast and read your website occasionally. Suggestion for your podcast? Possibly look into the current return call mobile phone scam that has been running in Australia. It might be a little off topic from what you report on. I and people from my office have been hit almost daily this month. Just a suggestion. Well, thank you very much for that, Michael. It's a very good suggestion, actually. So I've been hit by it too. Now, I was going to have someone from Telstra, Australia's largest telco, I suppose, on the line to talk about this, but I forgot to send the email, didn't I? The other day, I don't think I'm going to hear back from them. And then I looked in my email, and there it was. It was a draft, and by that stage, well, it was Friday, wasn't it? So it was late on Friday, so it was a bit late. Doesn't matter. There's plenty of information about it on the web, so let's see what we can do. We'll start with the missed call scheme. That's an interesting one. Basically, companies ring your mobile. They ring for a half a second or something, just long enough for your phone to pick up the number and lodge a missed call. You don't really have time to answer it, and that way it doesn't cost them a thing, does it? They just automatically dial all these numbers and, well, people say missed call on their phone. What are they going to do? They're going to call back, aren't they? Especially people in business or people who keep in contact with other people all the time. That they're just going to call the number back, find out who it is. Now, what happens when you call the number is that you get through to most of them here in Australia, at least, have been Melbourne or Sydney numbers. So basically, it's the standard call rate from the mobile, and they say, "Oh, congratulations, you've won a prize of some sort. Please ring a 1900 number, which is Australia's premium number." According to Telstra, the company was trying to get people to call a 1900 number charged at $2.97 per minute, and that way they would have a chance at winning a prize. Just a chance. They hadn't necessarily won it, they just had a chance. Of course, some people then went and rang that number, didn't they? So they got charged a fortune for it, and well, I suppose really, they deserve what they get. I mean, if you're stupid enough to go and call the 1900 number for something you from a missed call, from a recorded message which you've even had to call just to do it, then why? Why would you do that? I mean, it's obvious that it's a scam, but some people just don't seem to be able to register scams for some reason. Anyway, there have been reports of this happening in many places, Australia, the UK, the US, many others as well. Basically, the telcos are saying ignore the missed call unless it's from a number the customer recognises, a number you recognise. That's fine if you're not in business, or if you don't have to take calls from lots of people all the time. If you're doing that, then yes, you're going to get these missed calls, and you're going to want to return them. Fine, return them, just don't dial the 1900 number. Okay, there's a few other ones, so I've picked these up from the Telstra website. I'll put a link to that particular page in the show notes. According to a viral email, people are charged $100 if they call the missed call number. Oh, sorry, that's the same story. No, that's not true, basically. Why is it? This is something that bothers me. Why is it whenever there's a scam like this, it's mysterious, it's one of these missed call scams or whatever, people suddenly say, oh, well, let's just send out an email saying, yeah, this costs $100 if you call the number back. Why do people do this? What possible motive could you have for doing this? The bottom line is, you're not going to be charged $100 for calling the missed call number. You're going to be charged the standard call rate. If you call the 1-900 number, well, you're taking your life into your own hands, aren't you? There's one from another one from the Telstra website. This is actually number 2 this time, so we're on the right one. If you send this text message onto 10 other Telstra prepaid plus users, you will receive $200 credit that will expire in a month. Again, not true. On Telstra's website, though, they do actually say that Telstra puts service message at the start of messages so you will know which messages are from us. Anyone could write service message, surely. Is there something in the phone system that blocks people from sending messages that start with service message? Would have liked to talk to someone from Telstra and ask them that question. Actually, would have been very interesting. Now, here's one that's turned up all over the place. A few variations of this one. The one on the Telstra website, dialing 90# allows another person to access your mobile service via your SIM card. No, it's not true. There are other variations of that where they say dialing a certain number will, when someone rings you, will give them access to your phone system or some other nonsense. It's not true. Well, okay, it's not true generally. If you're really concerned about it, then contact your telco, but I don't think that security flaw has existed in phone systems for ages. I remember Telstra said once that their old PABX systems did have a flaw of some sort like that, and in fact there was a story either earlier this year or late last year where one of the private hospitals here in Canberra got, they had an old PABX system, and someone found their way in and started making all of these strange international calls, and it cost them a fortune, but, it's generally not true. The only time I've ever heard of this happening is on the PABX system, so if you've got a PABX in your business or your office, whatever, just check with your telco if you're concerned. Here's another one. Computer email viruses can affect mobile phones. That's not true. Telstra say that in mid-2000, a rumour surfaced claiming that a virus called Trimophonica, or Virtual Basic Script, was causing damage to mobile handsets after being transmitted by email. No, afraid it's not true. Symantec, can't stand their antivirus software, but they have very good information on their website about viruses and virus hoaxes. Personally, I use Avast antivirus, but that's just personal choice on Windows anyway. They've actually got two variants of it from 1999. One saying that if you receive a phone call and your mobile displays ace- on the screen, don't answer this call, end the call immediately. If you answer the call, your phone will be infected by the virus. The virus will erase all IMEI and IMSI information from both your phone and your SIM card, which will make your phone unable to contact with the telephone network. The other one, all mobile phone in digital system can be infected by this virus if you receive a phone call and your phone display unavailable on the screen. For most of digital mobile phones with a function to display incoming call telephone number, don't answer the call, end the call immediately, blah, 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 blah. The similarity between the two emails is that on both they tried saying that CNN were covering the story well. It's not true. Ignore it. The one that is true, though, it is possible for mobile phones to be infected. Don't pretend for a moment that it's not. But this is from BBC News on the 16th of June 2004. The first ever computer virus spread by mobile phones has been sent to antivirus firms. No infections have been reported and the worm is harmless, but it is proof that mobiles are at risk from virus writers. The worm, known as Kabir, infects phones and devices running the Symbian operating system. Antivirus firms are divided on whether it will open the floodgates to similar viruses. It is a milestone in the timeline of viruses, but technically is not that special, said Graham Cluley, a senior technology consultant at Sophos Antivirus. When the infected file is launched, the mobile phone screen displays the word Carive. Every time the mobile phone is turned on, the worm will launch itself and scan the area for other phones to infect, sending a copy of itself to any it finds. Mr. Cluley sees it as an interesting first rather than something that needs to be of great concern to phone users. I really should read this before actually trying to read it out. Basically it was a proof of concept one. So they wrote something, they proved that it was technically possible, but I mean, this one was limited by Bluetooth technology, so other phones capable of receiving the thing, had to be within 30 metres, and even then they'd get a security alert saying unknown file coming in or something to that effect. Where do I put that bit of paper? Going back to the Telstra list for a moment. Find that bit of paper, there it is. Answering a call, displaying the ID, saying ID unavailable will damage your mobile phone. Again, not true. It's just because the person is withholding their caller ID. And then the usual nonsense, if you send this message to 8 people, you will receive 1 month's free SMS. It's not true. When there are emails like this that have been doing the rounds forever, it's not true. Just don't believe it. And basically, if you see something that you're a little bit suspicious of, but it looks legit, it looks a bit like this, contact your telco, contact your ISP, contact whoever. But most of the time, these things just, they're too good to be true, and they are, and that's the golden rule, really. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is. So, just keep an eye out on that. So, I don't know why people do this, it's silly. I'm shuffling papers here. I misplaced this paper, and I haven't misplaced it. It's just over here. I found it. It's good. I thought I'd lost it, and if I'd lost it, I'd be in trouble, because then we wouldn't have the persiflage puzzle in front of me, and that wouldn't be any good. Anyway, seeing as this is a shorter episode of Samuel's Persiflage than usual, I think we might play a song.
Did you ever think when you eat Chinese, it ain't pork or chicken but a fat Chinese? Yet the food tastes great so you don't complain, but that's not chicken in your chicken chow mein. Seems to me I ordered sweet and sour pork, but Garfield's on my fork, he's purring here on my fork. There's a cat in the kettle at the Peking Moon, the place that I eat every day at noon. They can feed your cat and you'll never know, once they wrap it up in dough, boy, they fry it real crisp in dough. Shaolin asked if I wanted more as he was dialing up his buddy at the old pet store. I said, not today, I lost my appetite. There's two cats in my belly and they want to fight. I was sucking on a rolling in a Tums or two, when I swear I heard it new, boy. And that is when I knew. There's a cat in the kettle at the Peking Moon. I think I gotta stop eating there at noon. They say that it's beef or fish or pork, but it's purring there on my fork. There's a hairball on my fork.
Well, that would have to be one of Natty's favourite songs, I'd have to say. Natty wouldn't mind the cat being in the kettle, but, I don't think I really want to have that for dinner, personally. Anyway, that's the show for this month. We'll have to catch up on an episode somewhere, because we're supposed to be at episode 7 by now, but we're only at episode 6, so I suppose I've got some room to catch up there. Before we go, did you get the persiflage puzzle? Well, it's a compact disc, or CD as some people know them. So, strangely enough, I asked a few people if they knew what CD stood for, and they didn't. So, if you're wondering, it stands for compact disc. There aren't that many shopping centres. I don't think there are, there'd be very, very, very few that don't have at least one compact disc in them somewhere. whether it be running the music on the PA system in one of the stores or in the shopping centre, or whether there's a music store selling CDs. It's, I know the clue is cryptic, but you have to do that sometimes. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you've got any feedback, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. And, of course, there's also the Send Me a Voice Message button on the Samuel's Persiflage website and in the show notes. I look forward to hearing from you, and I will see you again for the next episode, I hope. This has been Samuel's Persiflage. I'm Samuel Gordon Stewart. Until next time, ta-da.